That's a common question I hear when talking to people about September 11th, 2001. Where were you? Some people were already in uniform serving our nation. Some were getting ready to, already in basic training. Some were about to. After the attacks, a lot of people raised their right hands to leave what they know and contribute and fight back. Some, like myself, were still in school, like most kids, not really processing what I was seeing on the TV, as my teacher had rolled it into the classroom on a cart. Some weren't even born yet, but would end up joining a military shaped into what it is today because of the attacks and the war on terror. And there's no doubt that 9/11 has a huge impact on our nation and military. And as we approach the 25th anniversary of that horrible day, we would be remiss if we didn't take a step back and reflect a little. Brigadier General Ian Gillis is one of the last current serving Maniac air crew members to respond and take to the skies that day. Now, if you remember when the attacks happened, all flights were grounded, but General Gillis, along with a handful of other aircraft, were still in the sky. Now, he's here to chat with us, share his story, drink some coffee, and reflect a little. He's no stranger to the Maniac Radio Show, but to some of you, his story may seem foreign. A quarter century has passed. Let's bring him in. Let's talk. You've done this before, sir. do we want to do the new title?
Brigadier General Ian Gillis, the Assistant Adjutant General for Air, many titles, yeah. Commander of the Maine Air Guard. When I talk with my Army counterparts, I'm the Air Component Commander because they're the Land Component Commander.
Oh, okay.
So depending on the venue, yeah, I have many titles.
Depending if you're in trouble or not and you get a report to your office, that turns out which hat you're wearing.
Exactly, yeah. And what the boss wants me to do, right? When the tag calls, whatever she wants is what we do.
Yeah, I hear that. It makes sense. All right, sir. So we talked about this beforehand. I want to give a kind of a background for those that are going to be hearing this that don't know, that haven't watched previous videos or listened to previous podcasts where you've been on. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm going to do a quick intro as to what we're talking about. So General Gillis is one of the last remaining members in uniform that physically responded to New York on 9/11. Of course, that was 25 years ago. So that's to be expected that that people retire and move on and all that. So I think it's just a couple of you. I think it's you and Chief Robichaud, maybe.
So I think now the there may be a maintainer or two that launched with us during that time frame. But crew-wise, I'm pretty sure that it's Chief Robichaud and myself, mm-hmm. The only ones left from September 11th, 2001.
Wow. So 25 years. So 5 years ago, we did your PA shop, because you were the wing commander at the time, a big video production, and it was a joint production. I think it was asked by General Farnham at the time to do a joint Army Air video production. So I got to travel around the state and meet some people that I hadn't met before and kind of hear their perspective and their story on where they were when 9/11 happened. But we did interview you, and I remember kind of getting into a conversation similar to what we're going to get into this morning, about what it was like and kind of what you were feeling at the time. And, so if you wouldn't mind, kind of give us a quick background or, on what kind of took place that day and where you were and what happened from your perspective.
Sure. So it was a Monday morning. We had just finished drill weekend. We'd had, an exercise at the wing, that weekend. And so it was a pretty busy weekend as far as training and accomplishing, training tasks and getting ready for things, inspections and that kind of stuff. Monday morning, I was in a class for a new software package that we were getting in scheduling. I was in aircrew scheduling at the time. And so I was down at Comflight, and I remember, you know, over the PA system, people, you know, you'd in the background, you'd hear so-and-so, please report to, so-and-so, please report to. And I kind of thought it weird, right, that, you know, couldn't tell you how many folks, but it was a lot that were being called back to their offices, and, you know, didn't really think much of it other than, that's strange. And then I got called back to my office. So I head up to scheduling in 518, and we had old TVs, you know, not flat screen TVs.
The tube ones.
The tube,
yeah,
TVs.
Like that one up there. Very
similar to that one up there, yeah. 518 was a relatively new building back then, and every room had, you know, a TV up in it for closed circuit TV, and I think we had, you know, we had cable piped in, or you know, at least a couple news channels piped into that TV. And I remember walking into the office and seeing something on the TV. News about the Twin Towers being hit. But in my mind, I looked at that and I said, wow, they're going all out for the exercise. I thought, you know, this was just the wind down from the exercise. Honestly, that's what went through my mind as I looked at it. And, you know, as I get in the office, they said, hey, we're trying to crew airplanes. We're trying to caulk on airplanes. And that's when it kind of hit me that that wasn't closed circuit TV. That wasn't a feed for the exercise. That was, you know, real. So, you know, as a unit, we had a couple aircraft airborne that day. One was going TDY, I think, down to Charleston. They got diverted to support, I think, an AWACS off the coast. We had another jet that was airborne just doing local training, and they dumped all their gas into some fighters. And then 25 years is a long time ago, so memories fades a little bit. I think we generated 4 more aircraft that day. Throughout the morning, we would launch an aircraft. I was on the last jet to launch that day, well after noon. The first couple of jets just kind of launched. We were all sitting in cockpit alert. The crew chief had the radio on downstairs. He was in the truck, and he would key his interphone switch so we could hear what was going on. This is back in the days before cell phones, you know, before smartphones, right? So, you know, that's how we were getting our updates of what was going on. And we were sitting there ready to launch, just waiting for a launch order, and we get called back into operations. So we came back into operations. The reason they called us back in is because we were trading in our peacetime modes and codes, our peacetime identification documents for wartime.
So at that point, what were you thinking?
So, yeah, I mean, talk about taking a 2x4 to the face, right?
Yeah.
It's like, wow, I'm over my own country, and we're talking about wartime modes and codes. Stark realization that things have changed. A sobering moment. But we didn't actually get to soak that moment in and deal with it because we got the order to launch as we were picking up our new Comtech. So we ran to the aircraft and started engines. And then the other kind of sobering moment, I think, you know, at that point I'd been flying here at Bangor for 8-9 years now. And there's a rhythm to what you do when you start engines and you taxi out, right? And so we started engines and we called ground and asked for taxi clearance. And the clearance was you're cleared any taxiway, any runway.
That's not normal, right?
That's not normal. And I think I repeated it back because that's what you do. And it didn't really sink in. We got to the end of the runway, and when you get to the end of the runway, you contact tower and request clearance to take off. And so, you know, we called tower, and tower said, "You're already cleared." "What?" "You're cleared any runway, unrestricted climb, contact tactical."
Wow.
Okay. So again, kind of right, that sobering moment of this is not normal. This is big. This is something different. We got airborne. We actually didn't go to New York. We supported Boston, Logan. And our job was to refuel the F-15s that were monitoring traffic coming into Logan. Mm-hmm. I think another kind of, I'll say aha moment, sobering moment. I use that term a lot, but it's true. It's that moment when you realize that this is not a normal day.
Mm-hmm.
The F-15s that were orbiting over Logan were cleared to fire on any civilian airliner that deviated from landing at Logan.
Wow.
So, you know, you think of weapons free in the United States. Wow, something bad's happened. And I don't think at that point, as crews, we knew some commercial airliners had hit at that time the Pentagon and the Twin Towers. But we didn't know that they were terrorists. We didn't know how it had happened. You know, what, right? It's like, all we knew.
Was it an accident? Like, you know, type of
right.
thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, how could it be an accident? Three airplanes.
Right.
Right. But you don't know. Right. And so you're trying to sort it all out in your head and do your mission. The other thing that I clearly remember, the F-15s that we were working with got dispatched to intercept, I think it was Maine 9-3, the jet that was supposed to be going to Charleston that had refueled the AWACS. They'd given all our gas and landed in McGuire. And then McGuire had given them just enough gas to get home and wanted them off their ramp. And so they were flying back. I'll go back to, we had changed our modes and codes from peacetime to wartime. Well, Maine 9-3 didn't have wartime codes. And so they weren't squawking the appropriate codes. So we had our F-15s that we were working with were dispatched to investigate. I came up on our maniac common freak and got a hold of Maine 9-3 and said, "Hey guys, you're about to have company. Things have changed. You don't have the right codes." Because I didn't want to get too specific,
yeah.
But you know, give them the hint that they needed. And I said, "Just play it cool." 15s went, and of course, saw the maniac livery that they fly with every
yeah.
day, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's one of ours. And we're able to positively ID, and you know, on Maine 9-3 gets to come back to Bangor. But you know, when you're in a combat zone, all that kind of stuff is just, you know, another day in the job, right? But when you're sitting over Massachusetts, and that's what's going on, it's a sobering reality of things have changed in the world.
You and your crew didn't know the full scope of what was going on with everything. No one really did. I mean, I would imagine. But I mean, what were you thinking? What were you feeling at that moment? Were you worried that your family was worried? Did they know anything, or did they just think it was another day at the office for you? Or,
well, my wife was in the unit at the time. And so I honestly can't remember if I think I had contact with her before launching. one of the amazing things, and I'll probably get the statistic wrong, but it'll be in the ballpark. I think 97% of the wing showed up within like 8 hours.
Wow.
And mind you, we did not do a wing recall that day.
Really?
People saw the news and said, wow, I'm going to head into work. And so, you know, we only had a few folks that were, you know, some airline folks or some people that didn't live within the state that didn't make it into work that day.
Mm-hmm.
And Marsha, my wife, was, you know, one of them that showed up that day and said, hey, all right, what can I do? So from that standpoint, not really worried. You know, about what the family thought, because I knew that she was tied in. And honestly, I think we were pretty much just focused on doing our job, right? You know, this is what we trained for. None of us had it in our brain that we would be doing that over the continental United States. But it's what we trained for. So you focus on the job at hand, and do that. It was probably months later before I was really unpacking all of that.
Like processing it, thinking
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, because I landed off that sortie. The chief of scheduling at the time was trying to put crews on alert. We were cocking jets on so that they were ready to launch, not knowing what's going to come next. And so we basically went into 24/7 ops right from there. I went home, slept for about 6 hours, came back in for the morning shift as a scheduler and a planner, and that kind of started the next probably year that was just a blur. Cycling between combat air patrols over Boston or New York, lines of alert, and then, you know, scheduling, you know, just keeping bodies, doing the mission. You know, that kind of cycle was probably through the spring, and then it started to taper off until we kind of got to a steady state about a year later.
Wow. So at this point, for the majority, actually probably the majority of the wing, not just ops, but except for the small group of people that were around during Desert Storm, Desert Shield, this was the first conflict since then that our wing had experienced or the world, you know, our country had experienced, right? So this is kind of a wake-up call.
Yeah. So Desert Shield, Desert Storm, I was in maintenance at the time during that, and we were kind of running a 24/7 op at that point. From Desert Storm to 9/11, we had participated in Northern Watch, Southern Watch, Bosnia, Kosovo, all of those actions. But that, you know, that's all somewhere else, right? That's not here, not really doing anything from Bangor. But 9/11 starts, we're actively involved from home station. And that drumbeat's kind of continued in the last 25 years. You fast forward to 2003 and Operation Iraqi Freedom. We participated in an air bridge from here. We ran the air bridge up in the Northeast. We had two units that came, deployed up here with us, and we ran what we call air bridge missions, which are take off out of Bangor, offload 100,000 pounds into a C-5 or C-17 so that they can go direct into the theater. And we did that as a surge operation for probably about 6 months as well. And then, you know, kind of from that point forward, anytime something happens in Europe or CENTCOM, Bangor kind of gets surged up, and we support the mission from home station. One of the things, and you've seen me talk about it, right? I'm gesturing to the front of the building here. We have our Outstanding Unit Award, and I don't know, there's 13, 14 devices on that thing, right? But right next to that is a Meritorious Unit Award, which is given for direct support of combat operations, right? We have two of those awards, and that's because of the strategic location of the Bangor Maine and the Maine Air Guard. We have that unique capability of directly supporting combat ops from our home station. I often say to folks, you know, those Outstanding Unit Awards, those are pretty darn cool. But those Meritorious Unit Awards, that's something. Just speaks to the level of activity here over the last 25 years.
I think if I remember right too, sir, that at one time, or maybe we still are, at one time I thought we were the only Air National Guard unit to have
the Meritorious. For home station?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I don't know the answer to that question. I know that there are several units that have gotten the Meritorious Unit Award for home station work, but I don't know Guard, Reserve, or Active Duty who it is.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up.
But we were one of the first ones, if not the first, to get it.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. That could be the history I'm thinking of there. So you mentioned that the majority of the wing had come in. And on their own accord, because they saw the news and they responded. You were up in the air. So, I mean, do you know, I mean, what was it like? I'm sure you saw it once you guys got back too, but I mean, I'm sure this place was just teeming and busy.
Yeah. I use the phrase sleepy little guard base an active duty base or more, probably more like a deployed base, right? The amount of activity 24/7, we were launching kind of around the clock to support combat air patrols over, like I said, Boston and New York, or other locations, kind of Boston, New York were our typical ones, but we would go other places if we needed to go. I think our highest flying year ever was fiscal year 2002. Our combat air patrol, and for folks that don't understand, we use that term in the AOR, in the deployed environment. We do combat air patrols, and it's typically a tanker and some fighters that are sitting over a location just patrolling. If something happens, you've got that asset airborne ready to respond. So that was the package that we would support after 9/11. And those were typically 6 hours at a whack. 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for the majority of the year. I think it was probably April before we started to ramp off that. That's a lot of flying time.
That's a lot, yeah.
And oh, by the way, that's when I say 7 days a week, that's Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, right? We're not taking a knee at any of that time. We are flying that drumbeat the whole time.
I think people tend to forget that. They kind of overlook that. That's that you guys were doing that, 365. Like that's a lot. And especially where, like you said, being a sleepy guard base, like that's not something the majority of the people out here were probably used to. Unless maybe they were prior active duty or whatever, but I can only imagine that it was everything from, obviously you're speaking from the ops side, but even security ramp ups, I'm sure, were wild.
Yeah, the whole base was involved in that effort, right? There was nobody that was left out. Everybody is supporting that mission. Like you said, security was. Not only did we have all of our security forces, actively working mission at that time, a number of Army Guardsmen were here as well. Numbers kind of fade over 25 years, but, along the magnitude of, 25, 35 Army Guardsmen here supporting. And, you know, security forces would put those folks on the front gate, you know, because they're not necessarily trained about how to, you know, interdict close into the airplane and things like that. But they were mixed into our formations. And a lot of those folks ended up becoming air guardsmen. After a while. But yeah, the level of effort and, you know, two shifts of maintenance, right? We were working, maintenance was working overnight. There's a picture that maintenance uses when their folks retire, and it's the old hangar with a tanker in there, all kinds of work going on in the middle of the night. And it's an awesome photo. It just looks really, really cool because the hangar's all lit up, but it's all dark around it. And that's taken from that time frame when we were doing surge ops at night.
It tells a story.
Tells a big story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet. Where did everybody, the alert crews that were here, I've actually never stepped foot in the alert facility, but, where did everybody sleep? Where, I mean, like you mentioned, you were able to go home. Was that a normal thing where people, if local pilots could go?
So, when we weren't on alert, yeah, we would, you know, we could go home. For folks that, you know, folks that didn't live locally, we'd put them up in hotels. We also, I think, had some folks over at the Horizon Inn, the old airman's dorm. But the alert facility that we have, it's from Strategic Air Command days when we would pull alert, big enough for two SAC alert crews. So we would, you know, we would double bunk people in our alert facility. Luckily, we had that. A lot of places don't have that. So it gave us a good place to go. You know, depending on how many crews we had on alert, though, it was pretty tight quarters in there.
Yeah, I bet.
But, you know, a really decent facility to work out of. Today we have, you know, one crew sitting alert in there. Pretty spacious. Everybody's got their own room.
And, yeah.
You know, you got two TV rooms. So if you don't like what the co is watching, you can go over into the other TV room and watch what you want.
I'm sure times have changed. It's definitely different. That's for sure. So you have a unique perspective versus, like, say, Chief Robichaud or some of the other responding crews from that day. And, oh, I mean, really a unique perspective compared to, you know, say a DSG or another full-timer that responded out here that were support operations on 9/11. You have a unique perspective because you later became the wing commander and now, you know, being the main Air National Guard commander. What have you, over the last 25 years, because of that day, you know, as a broad perspective, how have you seen, you know, our operations and our wing change? It's a loaded question. It's a big question. But
it's a huge question. Someday I'll write a book on it.
I bet.
Honestly. And the title of that book is going to be, This Is Not My Father's Air National Guard.
Oh, that's cool.
And, you know, as you know, I'm second generation maniac. And I think my father probably saw two distinct guards in his time. You know, and people hate this term, but I think it was true in our early days as an air guard that we were a flying club. And then we became a much more professional force. And when I say that, you know, from 1947, right? 47 into the 50s, I think there was maybe a somewhat of a flying club mentality. And again, I think that's probably unfair because we were a new force and we're figuring things out. But as you fast forward, you know, we start sitting air defense alert and, you know, become a highly professional organization. And in our unit here in 1976, we move into SAC, with the KC-135 and we sit alert there. But throughout my father's career, the guard was always that reserve force that, you know, break glass in case of emergency type organization, right? A squadron might get picked up and taken to Vietnam to help support. But it was always kind of that fill-in, augment role. Desert Storm, I think you see that start to change. Again, big operation, active duty needs help, we go do it, but we play a much more major role. Mm-hmm. And then from there to 9/11, the idea that we're going to go and help out, you know, all the deployments to Bosnia, Kosovo, Northern Watch, Southern Watch, those kind of things, we start doing a little bit more to augment on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. And then 9/11 hits, and post 9/11, we're no longer a reserve that comes to help in the time of need. We're a total force, operational, standing shoulder to shoulder with our active duty counterparts, playing as big a role, if not bigger in some cases, than the active duty. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the change that you see in 9/11. The fact that the Guard goes from this reserve force, break glass in case of emergency kind of organization to, hey, we're here day to day, and we are embedded with you. And, you know, I think the Air Force does it better than the other services. My Army counterparts are cringing right now. But total force isn't just a saying. Leadership at the Air Force level uses that term purposefully because they understand that without the Guard and Reserve, they can't do what they're supposed to do. That's the shift. And I think we could, you know, the nuance between how that actually occurs from in the last 25 years kind of changes a little bit too as we get to today. You know, case in point, right? With Epic Fury, the number of Guard tails that are out in the system doing work.
How does it make you feel as a former wing commander, you know, the main Air National Guard commander, speaking of current operations and the current contingency that we're involved with, comparing that to what was going on, what started 25 years ago and the evolution to where we are now? You know, just yesterday I was watching crew chiefs scramble around and maintenance troops scramble around the returning jet, doing what they do best and really kicking butt and taking names, and some of them weren't even born when 9/11, you know, had happened, but they know that heritage and legacy is there, and you can see that sense of pride and that pep in their step, which is pretty cool. How does it feel, given your position? There must be a big sense of pride.
I was, you know, as you're asking the question, I was kind of formulating, and the thought that comes to mind is damn proud. Damn proud of the team. And you mentioned heritage, and I'm going to have to go back for a minute here. Post-Desert Storm, and I'm going to attribute it to John Bronson, a former pilot and training flight instructor here at the unit. And maybe it wasn't his great idea, but I'm going to give it to him. In Desert Storm, we were launching six-ship tanker formations, something that theoretically we were trained to, but we didn't do often and we weren't good at it. And John came back after that and said, hey, we need to do better. We need to be better prepared because the next time somebody asks us to do this, we want to be good at it. And so, of course, I come into the flying organization just post Desert Storm and got to benefit from that. He put together a training program to the point where at the drop of a hat, this unit could launch a six ship and do it almost radio silent. We were that good at it. And we would, every drill weekend we were doing one, and usually at least a couple during the month, we would do a large formation. I say that so that you get a sense that became baked into our DNA. And I would say even before that, right? This organization has always wanted to excel. You know, good enough is not good enough for us. We always want to be masters of our craft. And John certainly wanted to see that for the organization. Coming up to this conflict, Epic Fury, the organization realized that the new data linking system that was coming on board to the tanker would be important in the next conflict. And then some other training things, getting prepared for you know, the future. Operations in the wing really worked hard to train, to get better at using this new system, to get better with scramble launch procedures and to hone their craft. And one of the things that I've heard from the AOR during Epic Fury is that main air guard crews are good at what they do. And so I think to myself, part of our heritage, right? I think to myself, I can see John Bronson standing up on the stage talking about why this was important so that we were ready for the next fight. And I think to myself, hey, we're still doing that today. We're still getting ready for the next fight. So going back to proud of the organization, proud of the fact that we're experts at our craft, no matter where you are in the organization, we're good at what we do. But the fact that we also aren't resting on our laurels, we're always training, we're always picking up what's the next thing that we need to be good at and getting after it. So
can't quite put my finger on it, but I feel like that is kind of our part of our mantra or our ethos. Like that's that we're always striving to do something different or try something new, and it's never good enough, like you said, to stay complacent and to be comfortable in what you know. That's wild. What would you, if there was some way, some magical Back to the Future, Marty McFly way to get in that DeLorean and head back to 2001 to 9/11 and talk to your younger self, what would be something you'd say? What would be that elevator pitch to the younger Captain Gillis? Was that your rank or what was your,
On the drive in, I was trying to figure out, 25 years ago is a long time ago.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, man, I should pull up my MPF rip to see, cause it was right around that time frame that I got promoted to major. I think I was still a captain though when I launched, and then got promoted that fall. But, wow. I think I would probably say, take a breath. And what I mean by that is, we charged hard, and I don't know that I really took a breath for 6-7 months. Like I said, we were very, very busy doing caps and alerts and all of the other things. And there's a lot of time missed. The term today is work-life balance. My family would probably tell you that I have a not a good work-life balance. But it's a challenge, right? I mean, you're trying to do for the organization, you're trying to do, the maniacs are my family. So try and take a breath and try and understand the significance of what's going on. You asked it a couple of times, did I really understand the significance of what was going on 9/11? Nope. Didn't stop to take a breath. Head down doing the mission. And probably, like I said, unpacking that probably 6-8 months later. That's the advice. Take a breath and reflect on what's going on, and try and carve out that time to reset.
Do you think that same advice could be relayed to not just younger air crews, but younger troops, younger maniacs that are on 11 right now with current operations?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a challenge, right? I'll wholeheartedly admit, do as I say, not as I do, right? The course I just came back from, general officer course, we talk a little bit about taking care of yourself in that course. And the instructor said, hey, I'm going to tell you something you haven't done in the last 30 years of your career. And they talk about operating at peak efficiency and high ops. And all of us, as he's detailing this out, everybody in the room was like, yeah, that's where I'm at. And he goes, all right, great. You shouldn't spend more than a little bit of your time in the day in that area, because you can't do it. You cannot operate that way. But in the military, that's where we do. High performing, high stress, getting the job done. His point was, yeah, you can do that for a short period of time, but you need to reset. It's awful to say, but I've got to do public math. That's always dangerous. 38 years into my career, somebody finally got through and said, hey, you need to
take a breath.
You need to take a breath.
Yeah.
So, like I say, this is a do as I say, not as I do. And I know that none of us really do that, but we got to figure out a way to take that breath so that we can recover and be ready to sprint again.
That's cool that they said that, to you guys. Cause that's, I feel like at least throughout my career, it's always been take care of your people. My first flight chief, take care of you guys, take care of your people, feed them on crew and on flight, on shift and, make them food, check in with them, see how they're doing. But you never really hear about check yourself. Like how are you doing? Like how are you doing yourself and take care of yourself? I feel like you don't hear that as often as you probably should.
I think we're getting better at it. Good leaders are worried about their people, and it's easy to not worry about you.
It's true.
Everybody says, all the experts say, well, if you don't take care of you, you're not around to take care of your people.
Very true.
So.
Very true. And I feel like that's so... Yeah, that advice matters more now than ever, given the current climate, for sure. That's a lot of information. I do appreciate you coming in and doing this. Is there anything you want to add? Anything we didn't cover? I think that this is definitely a good starting point for just. As a podcast episode that people can listen to, that this will be released the week of in September. I think that this is a good starting point for people to kind of reflect and look back on, and again, kind of full circle, relate it back to what we're doing now.
Yeah. So I guess I think I'd like to say thanks. Thanks to all of our retirees, all of our former maniacs, all of our current members that are still getting after mission. We've got a really proud tradition here of accomplishing the mission and getting after it and not settling for just getting by, but doing it really, really well. And that's not because of the airplanes here. That's not because of any of the physical structures here on base. It's because of the people. Maniacs care about what they do and about the impact they have. And it's not just ops. It's not just maintenance. It's the entire organization. We need everybody here in order to be able to do our jobs and to function. So everybody has a piece of it. I'd just like to say thanks to all of those folks for doing the mission the last 38 years of my career, right? I've seen it from an airman, one striper, all the way up through, and just fantastic people getting after mission and taking care of each other. So thanks for all you do, all that you are doing now, for all that you're going to continue to do in the future. I appreciate it.
That's awesome, sir. Thanks a lot. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it.
A big thank you to the General for taking the time to sit down and talk, and an even bigger thank you to all the men and women who have chosen to serve in uniform. Our nation was reshaped after the events of 9/11, but our freedoms and our liberties remain the same, and that's because of you and your willingness to serve. So to everyone in uniform, past and present, thank you. And as we move into a busy weekend, I challenge you to talk to your peers and fellow airmen. Ask them about 9/11. Ask them why they joined. Ask them, where were you? I'm Senior Master Sergeant Andy Sinclair with the 101st Air Refueling Wing Public Affairs Office, and this is the Maniac Radio Show. Take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and never forget